Blog Talk Radio.
This is JJ Bomber. You are listening to Well Armed Radio.
Good evening, sheepdogs. Welcome to Well Armed Radio, where freedom is our best friend. Thank you for joining us in our weekly vigorous, relentless, and many times ruthless pursuit of freedom. We are broadcasting live from the very Well Armed studio in New Berlin, Wisconsin. My pleasure to speak with the most informed gun owners in the state. That would be you guys. You are your community's finest. With a face for radio and a voice for silent movies, my name is Nick Clark. I'm the president of Wisconsin Carry and the host of Well Armed Radio. And I encourage you to be a part of the show with your calls, questions, comments, criticism in the chat using the Blog Talk chat platform, or you can call 563-999-3787, 563-999-3787. Start the show with the usual warning, no sacred cows here, and we'll do it tonight. First 15 minutes of the show, if anybody wants to call in, is open line. Anything you want to talk about, you call, you bring it up, I'll talk about it, we'll talk about it. After that, definitely appreciate your calls and your comments, but just if you do call, would like to keep it germane to the topic that we are discussing at that moment, whatever that would be, which tonight would be, we're going to talk about why liberals are pushing the vaccine so hard. I had a little bit of an epiphany this week about that. Talk about a new strategy for Wisconsin Carry and our communications, and then we're going to talk about what I think is a terrible decision out of the Wisconsin Supreme Court from this past week about the right to carry while intoxicated. And then, yeah, I think that'll take us up to the end of the show. Start off, had another nice weekend. First, happy Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to my mom. And happy Mother's Day to my stepmom, my mom Barb from Delavan, Wisconsin. And my stepmom Cindy, who lives in Thompsonville, Illinois. And hope they both had great Mother's Days. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. Happy Mother's Day to my fiance Kim. And again, all your mothers as well. Nice weekend. A little chilly for this time of year, but you know, it's as I always say, in Wisconsin you really have to conquer the weather. You can't let the weather beat you. You've got to beat the weather, because it's just too, you know, we don't have the kind of weather here like, I don't know, maybe Southern California or Texas or Florida, where you can count on a majority of it being good weather. So here you just you have to make the best of it. You have to learn to accommodate, learn to dress for it, you know, whatever you got to do to not let the weather get you down, because here in Wisconsin, it would definitely impede your plans if you let it. So played a little golf on Friday. That was really chilly, but there was nobody on the golf course. That's kind of nice. And then took the yacht out on Saturday, and the day started off not too bad. It was sunny. And then, the day was fine. I mean, by the end of the day and late afternoon, it was just clouded up, mid-afternoon clouded up. And so we had to zip the windows on the boat, on the yacht, and run the heat. And then it was comfortable, sat there and played some cards and chilled out. You know, I've just a side note, I've got, I have a rental property, and it's been a very good investment for me. Right now, housing prices are just going crazy. And I think that I must get probably 3 to 4 phone calls, text messages per week from people trying to buy my rental property. Right now in West Dallas, which is where my rental property is, you have to register if you have rental property. If your property is a rental, you have to register it. It doesn't cost you anything. You just have to register it. So whatever. I don't agree with it, but, you know, government does what government does. So then that makes it a public record. So now then people can look up the database. And so that's why I can thank West Dallas for the wonderful benefit of getting these multitude of phone calls every week from people who want to buy. Now, the the housing market, housing prices, between the fact that interest rates are low, housing prices, the supply is low. I hear stories about people offering $20,000, $30,000 over list for houses. All the people that own rental properties, I've seen that they're all selling as well because the housing prices are so high. I think this is short-sighted, though, and here's why. Because there's, I wouldn't say widespread agreement, but there's widespread concern that we're going to see some massive inflation. We've got all this government stimulus pumped into the economy. We've got supply chain disruptions last year from COVID, government imposed. You take all those things combined, and it really is a recipe for inflation. The government hasn't helped matters at all with the fact that the government has people, when they talk about, I talked about this in the show, maybe it was last week, maybe it was the week before, whenever you hear people say, you know, a 40-hour week at a low-skill job just, you know, can't support a family like it used to, and that's true. People want to blame capitalism for that. They want to blame the person to blame for that. There's two things to blame. I mean, well, the government is to blame. Government is the reason why stuff has gotten so expensive, why the value of a dollar isn't what it used to be, why the cost of a house is so high, why the cost of the government intrusion into these markets is what has, first, you know, government intrusion into the loans back in the, oh, what was it, the Community Reinvestment Act and all those things that led up to the mortgage crisis and all these policies, including tax policies, that drive people to borrowing, big borrowing for homes. But it's all, again, it's all government related, in addition to the devaluing of the dollar by all this deficit spending. That's where these massive deficits, people see, and I talked about, well, this was last week's topic. When Republicans try to, I shouldn't say scare, but when they try to find a hook to get people concerned about the massive deficit spending, what do they always say? You know, our grandkids' grandkids are going to be paying for this debt, which is true, but that's, again, that's just not a hook for people. Most people, you know, frankly, aren't all that, they're a little bit selfish. They're not all that concerned about their grandkids, grandparents, and what they do or don't have to pay, what they do or won't have to pay for, you know, worry about that when it comes. I mean, people are, you know, they're concerned about their kids, their grandkids, sure, their grandkids, 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 grandkids. Again, it's just, it's too abstract for people to be of big concern for them. What people should be more concerned about is in their, again, if you want to have a good, I don't want to call it a political hook because that makes it sound specious. It makes it sound petty, like, oh, it's politics. But no, if you want to have a good personal hook for people, explain to them that this, that government spending is what drives up the prices of all these things. So anyway, housing prices are through the roof. For that reason, everybody's selling. A lot of people, so I put, my rental property doesn't come up very often, but this past, it came up for rent. My tenants are moving out this July, late June, July. So I usually, my tenants that I tend to have a year or two is what I usually get. I shouldn't say that. Two or three, usually two or three for tenants when they move in. It's worked out well. This time I put the, I every time I list the house, the rental market's a little bit different. So I list it on Craigslist, start seeing what's coming in. I go to Craigslist and I look at other houses. So first I hear from people that, well, I don't want to get at this, I don't want to tell this story out of order. It won't make as much sense. So I go to Craigslist to see what the market's like. See, my place currently rents for $1,300 a month. Am I going to raise the rent? You know, what's the competitive environment? There's nothing out there. If you want to rent a single family house, there is like nothing out there. Some of the larger apartments around, Falcon, I think it's Falcon Glen down in Hales Corners, really, really nice apartments. You know, I've seen some apartments there, but in some of the bigger complexes, some of the high-end apartments, but I see like nothing out there for single family houses. I mean, I think I might've seen like one in West Dallas or maybe one in Wauwatosa. That was it. And so the market's great. It's a great time to be a seller of a home, but it's also a great time to be, to have rental property. I listed on Craigslist on Thursday, maybe it was Wednesday. I must have had 50 inquiries within the first 2 hours of people that were interested in seeing it. Just in a brief communication with a couple, because obviously there's no way I could contact all 50. Brief conversations with a couple of the people, they talk about how, yeah, the rental market's crazy. There's nothing out there. Some of the people that are looking for a rental, they were living in a house. Some of them had been in a house where they were renting a house for a while. And their landlord was selling the house and they had to move because the landlord was selling the house. So that, again, speaks to me how a lot of these people that had houses that they were renting, because a lot of it happened during the recession. People couldn't sell their house, so they started renting it out. You know, people like me, I built a new house in New Berlin, put my house in, I moved in late 2007, early 2008. People that moved in, people that, then the recession was underway, houses wouldn't sell. So rather than take a big loss and sell my house at such a discount, my old house in West Dallas, I just rented it out. And that worked out fantastically for me. So I think that's probably when a lot of people might have ended up in the same situation, had a house moved, couldn't sell their house, decided to rent it out. And then now that the housing market is so good, a lot of those people are selling their houses, and that's what they've done. And I think that's just made it worse in terms of the rental market being so tight. But I think it's short-sighted, because think about this. If I was to sell that house, then I got all kinds of cash. If you don't, it's called a 1031 exchange. If you don't take that money from the sale of real estate and roll it into some other real estate, I think you have 90 days to identify another property to purchase and 180 days to close on another property and take the proceeds from the sale of the one property and roll that into the purchase of another. Again, it's called a 1031 exchange. A lot of real estate investors do it. That's the way that you, otherwise, if you keep the money, then you got to pay your capital gains tax on the gain. So whatever the capital gains, if there's a $100,000 capital gain, I forget what it is right now, but if it's 20%, that's your cap gain. So boom, write the check for $20,000 out the door to Uncle Sam. On the other hand, if you can roll, you can do the 1031 exchange, you can keep that money. You don't have to, you know, and you can use that money on the purchase of your next, and you can just keep rolling it over and rolling over and get into bigger and bigger investments. So unless some of these people that are selling their houses are going to roll it into another real estate investment, I think it's a besides the fact that the housing prices are high, which would make you think, oh, it's time to sell, it's a terrible time to want to have cash. If all you're doing is selling the house and then keeping the cash on hand, you're going to pay capital gains on this proceeds on any of your capital gains. And then you're going to have cash on hand. And the last thing you want when inflation hits is cash. Cash is is when inflation hits, you want one of two things. You either want to owe money at a fixed rate, or you want to own assets, because assets go way, way up in value when there's inflation. Money, you know, $500 is still $500 when inflation hits, but then the cost of everything goes way up, so $500 doesn't purchase as much. So again, it's I sit there and I think I can't say I was tempted. The thought crossed my mind to sell because I get so many requests, so many inquiries. But again, two things: unless you're going to roll the money into another purchase, I thought about that. I thought about selling it, you know, if I get $200,000 from the sale of the house, turn around and roll that into maybe buy an apartment building, you know, like a 16-unit apartment or something for, you know, for $1 million, $200,000, there's your down payment. The nice thing about having a 16-unit, you just take one of the units, you make it the manager's unit, and you give them free rent to be the, quote, manager of the property. They handle the tenant screening, all that stuff, you know. If their rental apartment was $1,000 a month, yeah, they get, you know, you lose that $1,000 income, but you couldn't hire a full-time property manager for $15,000 to manage your property. But you could, you know, again, give someone that lives there free rent to act as the manager. They still, you know, it's not a full-time job. They still, but that, you know, so I know some people that do that with their apartment buildings. So, but again, other than that, all these people that are selling their houses, their rental properties, I mean, if they're just taking the cash and throwing it in the bank, I mean, that's just a terrible, terrible mistake to make when we're facing the prospect of runaway inflation. So, you know, I sit there and I speculate about what people might be thinking. And if that's the case, it just seems very short-sighted to want to sell a property at this point. I feel like there was something else I was going to chit-chat about before we started rolling in the show. And I don't remember. So I guess at that point, it means we should just jump in. Oh, I think I know what it was. I really hope that Donald Trump starts his own. This past week, Donald Trump has his new communication platform out. It's DonaldJTrump.com, but it's DonaldJTrump.com/desk, and that's where he puts out all kinds of information. But there's a rumor that Trump is going to have his own social media platform. And I just think the timing is so right. If you look at Trump has the name, the brand name to do it. Someone needs to rival. I mean, I think Facebook is a monopoly. Facebook, I've talked about that before in the show, all the reasons why I think Facebook is a monopoly. What Instagram became the fastest growing or biggest social media in the country Facebook gobbled them up. Classic monopolistic behavior, because at that point, the free market stops working if every time something starts to challenge the existing buys up the challenger. That's classic monopolistic behavior. Other things that we see Facebook doing with the censorship, and again, I know Facebook's a private company, and supposedly, oh, they can do what they want, they're a private company. Yes and no. That's why I look at the monopolistic practices of Facebook to say, hey, this is where I think it's anti-competitive. I think it's certainly it's anti-freedom. But then you see the collusion. You see the collusion between the collusion between Twitter and the App Store, and Parler getting deplatformed from the App Store and the Google Play Store. All those things are just classic monopolistic behavior, classic collusion, classic anti-capitalist, anti-competitive behaviors. And so for all those reasons, I don't think Facebook is operating in a free market. All that said, I do think that President Trump would have the resources, would have the brand name to put together a social media platform that could truly challenge Facebook. And if you think about it, I mean, Facebook made Mark Zuckerberg one of the richest people in the world. I don't know. I mean, I used to subscribe to Forbes and read the Forbes 400 every year. I no longer subscribe to Forbes because it's just a anti-Trump rag. I mean, they profess to be a conservative, or they not conservative. They used to profess to be a free market, a capitalism embracing publication, and I think they were. But Forbes was. I even was a subscriber during this time. Forbes was sold out to, I believe, a Chinese or a Hong Kong company that now owns them, and there was a change in editorial control. Steve Forbes is no longer the editor. I've seen Forbes take a big, big, big leap to the left. They had some stories, even a cover story. I think it was a cover story a few years back that said, how did they refer to it? They said, capitalism dead? Capitalism can survive, but it needs to be reinvented. It was just, again, it was out of the traditional lane for Forbes. Again, all reasons why I dropped my subscription. But I think Mark Zuckerberg is one of the richest people in the world. That was all from Facebook going public. I think the opportunity for a challenging platform is huge. I mean, we're not talking about some piddly thing here. I think it's an opportunity too big for Donald Trump to pass up starting his own social media platform. I mean, I think the chance there would be to be able to build a platform that is really could challenge Facebook. And if you look at Facebook's market capitalization, Facebook's monetary footprint, I mean, this is something that Trump's already a billionaire. I mean, this could make him one of the richest people in the world. It could make his family. It could be something that is transformative for his family. I mean, again, they're already extremely, extremely, extremely wealthy people, but this could really solidify them as, you know, some of the wealthiest. So I think it's an opportunity that they really need to take to build a platform that can challenge Facebook. There's such a platform out there, such a desire for conservatives to have a place that respects free speech, a place that conservatives, a place where they don't manipulate with algorithms and all. So I really hope that Trump, that the opportunity is so big. I really hope that Trump, the rumors that we're hearing is that it's coming, and I hope these rumors are true. And I hope that unlike a platform, just kind of like Twitter or kind of like Parler, I hope that it's more of a Facebook-like social media platform where people can have their pages, have groups, have, you know, just everything that you could essentially do with Facebook, but for conservatives, for, you know, which I believe is, well, I actually think it's more than half the country. That's one of the things that I've seen over the past, when I see how much and how many different methodologies the Democrats had to cheat. Now that I see, I can't help but wonder if we've been a 70-30 country this whole time. We always, you know, from George W. Bush, with such, when he lost the popular vote but won the Electoral College, we've always felt like we're a 50-50 country. It just seemed like we're a 50-50 country. But I don't think that, or I now wonder if we really are. If you, the media would have us believe that we're a 50-50 country. But what if there has been, and I think we've seen all the different methodologies for vote fraud. There was the vote fraud, we've seen reports here in Wisconsin, senior citizens, senior at retirement homes, nursing homes, how there's vote fraud in there, vote fraud with obviously this last election mail-in ballots. It used to be busloads of people coming up from Illinois with the name of a person before voter ID, with the name of a person and an address written on a piece of paper that they hand to these people getting off the bus, and they go in and vote. Again, it makes you wonder if maybe we weren't closer to a 70-30 country all along. And maybe not. I mean, because it's for certain this last November, I believe Trump won. I believe he won big. I believe he probably won by about 80 million to about 60 million votes instead of the, you know, 72 or 75 million to 75 million, 76 million for Biden. I think that it was probably a landslide victory for Trump. I think that that was an eye-opener that we're not this, what it comes right down to it, this 50-50 country teetering on the precipice of complete embracing of socialism. But it makes me wonder back. It makes me wonder Scott Walker's election. I can't help but think Scott Walker may well have won his election. If you take out all the vote fraud, and we've known for years, we've joked about it for years, conservatives, that we, you know, we have to overcome the margin of fraud. So it's not just enough to win. You got to overcome the margin of fraud. And I can't help but wonder if that margin of fraud has been bigger than we thought. And many of these races, I don't think Obama 2008, you know, that seemed like such a groundswell of popularity, groundswell of trendy thing to do to support Obama in 2008. I can't help but think, but maybe 2012, who knows if Obama, I mean, maybe Obama didn't, maybe Romney did win that election. That was a larger margin of victory than Trump. It just, again, makes me wonder now that we see today how many avenues of vote fraud exist out there. It can't help but wonder, has this been going on longer than we thought? And maybe not. Maybe the insanity didn't really start because we know with Trump derangement syndrome, this insanity really went full crazy with Trump. But you can't help but wonder, well, Scott Walker, I mean, the liberals in Wisconsin were full crazy over Walker. They had Walker, we called it Walker derangement syndrome. So you can't help but wonder, although, you know, Scott Walker won those other, he won his recall race and he won his reelection. I think perhaps here in Wisconsin, the massive fraud started with, oh, here's the other one, the vote fraud. If you look at what happened with this, Mark Zuckerberg's, you know, the $400 million he spent with the, I forget the name of the nonprofit, but it's the one that, if you've been following what's happening up in Green Bay, how Green Bay's elections were essentially turned over to a private third party group to run, private third party groups, these Zuckerberg founded groups. But that was, that took place in Milwaukee, Green Bay, Kenosha, Racine, and Madison. Milwaukee, Green Bay, Kenosha, Racine, Madison, biggest five cities in the state. Zuckerberg's people were in there doing everything from advising to having access to the mail-in ballots. I mean, it was some very, I believe, fraudulent stuff that was going on there. And, but again, 2016, would it? No, 2018, Walker, that was Walker's last race. Walker's last race in 2018, lost by 20,000. I believe Scott Walker probably won that race as well. I believe that race was probably stolen in the same way that Trump's victory in Wisconsin was stolen. In fact, I think it was probably easier for them to do with Scott Walker, because Scott Walker probably was, that probably was a pretty tight race. Scott Walker and Tony Evers. That may have been a tighter race, you know, a couple percentage points. But Scott Walker lost by 20,000 votes, ironic or interestingly, the same margin of votes that Trump lost by in Wisconsin. Same scenario, late night hours, Milwaukee County at Central Count there. Some funny numbers coming out, and all of a sudden, boom, here you go. So back to the point, Trump, his new social media platform, I think it's a huge opportunity. I can't imagine he doesn't see it. Facebook is, again, one of the largest market capitalization companies in the world, made Zuckerberg a mega, mega, mega billionaire, and I think Trump could potentially have a platform that has the brand name recognition to grow so fast. I really hope that MeWe would be, and MeWe has done well. I think MeWe's done well, all things considered, but it just doesn't seem to be. I'll get into this more when I talk about Wisconsin Carry's new communication strategy, but it just doesn't appear to me that MeWe is really going to be that substantive, legitimate challenger to Facebook. I don't see that coming. I think Facebook has learned from their mistakes. Hey, we got to stop banning people as much as we got to do. We got to do more subtle stuff, more logarithm manipulation, more gaslighting of people, less outright ban hammer because they don't want to drive too many people away and enable a third, an alternate platform example, MeWe. Trump has the cachet. Trump's brand name would be such that I think people wouldn't, because right now people only leave Facebook because they kind of have to. Either they're banned or they're just really incensed with the censorship and stuff that they feel they have to leave. Whereas with Trump, I think people would leave because they want to leave. People would leave because just the draw for the Trump brand. So fingers crossed, hope that comes true. First topic I had queued up, other than my little kind of small talky stuff there, leading into my main topics tonight, why are liberals pushing the vaccine so hard? You know, at first I thought it was just to push money to Moderna and to Pfizer. You know, Tony Fauci, he's got all his associates over at Moderna, that people that he's very close to, people that he worked with, closely with. I mean, certainly between all the grants and also, I mean, Fauci stands to benefit as Moderna makes money off the virus. So initially I thought, you know, the whole reason that Fauci's pushing the vaccine is to push money to the big drug companies. But now I realize that's only a segment of the push. I think that's definitely a motivation to push money to the big drug companies. But I thought this last past week, I think the real reason Democrats are pushing the vaccine is that Democrats do not want us to reach herd immunity without the vaccine. Because if we reach herd immunity without most people getting the vaccine, I think that sets a bad precedent for future pandemics. If we reach herd immunity without the vaccine, it says that we don't need government. It means that you have freedom and control. And that's why they offer permission for people with the vaccine, but no permission for people who had the virus. If you've looked at some of these recommendations from the CDC, they'll say, well, if you're vaccinated and the people you're with are vaccinated, well, then you could have a cookout or a small gathering. Again, they're obviously living in, you know, disconnect la-la land, because people have been doing that for years, well, for the last year, when this notion that Joe Biden says, oh, by 4th of July, you could be having a cookout with your family. It's like, hey, Joe, I mean, I understand he's senile and he's not going to get anyway. People have been doing that. People have been having cookouts with their families for, you know, 9 months now. They were doing it last summer. You know, maybe last April and May, people were kind of like still gun shy. But, you know, come last summer, June, July, August, people were kind of back to doing their thing. The statistics or the data even show that, like cell phone companies, people really did, those first 2 weeks, they really did hunker down. They stopped going places. But it was like a ghost town. It was weird. It was like in, you know, New Berlin. It's not like this thriving metropolis, but the cities or the streets here in New Berlin were quiet. You know, at rush hour, it's quiet. Usually, there's always, when New Berlin's a bedroom community, always people coming home and going. I mean, it was crazy quiet. But so all this time, the Democrats have said to people, if you get the vaccine and the people that you're with have a vaccine, well, then you can, you know, do this. You can go outside and in a group without a mask. But here's the thing. They haven't said, oh, if you have the vaccine or you've already had coronavirus. That hasn't been part of their value proposition to people. They haven't said, well, if you've had the vaccine or you've already had coronavirus, you can feel free to get together with people in groups. It's interesting why they've left that off. And you have to ask yourself, why have they left that off? Why have they left people who, have gotten the coronavirus and gotten better. So they've had the vaccine cannot possibly give you the immunity that having the virus gave you. It's not possible because all the vaccine does is trigger the immune response that the virus would give you without an actual viral infection that causes you to get sick. So it's not logical that the vaccine is, quote, better immunity than having gotten the virus. But yet you haven't heard in any of these CDC recommendations or any of these government bureaucratic standards that they've issued, regulations, recommendations that they've issued, none of them say, if you've had the vaccine or you've had the virus, you can stop wearing a mask out of doors. That's what kind of was the epiphany moment for me, that if we reach herd immunity without the vaccine, it says that we don't need the government. It means that you, the citizen, has freedom and control. And that's why they offer permission for people who've had the vaccine, but they don't offer permission for people who've had the virus. They start offering these privileges to people who've had the vaccine, but they don't offer those same privileges. They don't promote and advertise those same privileges for people who've had the virus. And the reason being is they don't want you to have control. The vaccine represents control. Remember, these rogue novel viruses come out a couple times a decade from shithole places around the world, SARS, swine flu, all this stuff. I mean, this Ebola, these things come about every 3 or 4 years. Now that the Democrats have seen the efficacy of weaponizing these viruses for political purposes, they want to keep that weapon in their arsenal. They want to get people in that mindset that they need the government because of these viruses. The virus gave Democrats carte blanche to seize dictatorial powers over literally every aspect of our lives. It enabled them to do what they've wanted to use climate change to do for decades. The Democrats for decades have wanted to use climate change as a reason to tell us where we could go, what we could drive, how much energy we could use, and it just didn't work. It just didn't have the hook because topic relates to earlier in the show. People don't really get concerned about the debt and its effect on grandkids, grandkids, grandkids. That's too abstract. People didn't really get on board with that in a majority sense because it's too abstract. So in 300 years, the oceans are going to be 2 degrees warmer. Not in my lifetime, you know. Nimble, that's what is it? NIMBY used to be not in my backyard. Nimble is not in my lifetime. People would nimble it. It's not in my lifetime. And they wouldn't worry about it. So that's why climate change didn't really get the hook. It didn't really grab people by the balls. But the virus did. Even people who would selfishly blow off, and again, I don't believe that climate change is human-based. is man, if there's climate change, I think it happens from the solar system and things far beyond our control. But the virus, that scared even, I'd say, half of conservatives. The virus was something that even half of conservatives hit their knees in fear over. They didn't hit their knee in fear over climate change, but they did hit their knees in fear over the virus last spring. And I watched it happen, and I was just, it just amazed me. Like, again, all the libs fell for it, and half of conservatives fell for it. I was like, my God, you guys, this is just the shutdowns of stuff. This is going right along with it. I mean, so the Democrats have seen the efficacy of weaponizing these viruses for political purposes, and they want to keep that weapon in their arsenal. The virus gave the Democrats blank check to seize all these dictator powers, all these emergency executive orders, again, over every aspect of our life. It enabled them to do what they wanted to use climate change to do for decades. But it didn't work, but it did work. It didn't work with climate change. It did work with coronavirus. And very, very few people challenged those dictatorial powers. Again, like look back to last spring. Those first 3 weeks of lockdown, again, half of my conservative friends were drinking the Corona-Noia Kool-Aid. But the powers that this gave government forced people to stay home, close businesses, close churches, close schools. Government decided who was essential and who wasn't. Checkpoints to give. Remember, last spring, checkpoints to get into some places. At one point, there was checkpoints to get into New York. They ignored laws. They ignored election laws. They issued endless emergency mandates. Local authorities even seized dictatorial powers through their health departments. CDC bureaucratic guidelines became, you know, follow the science, which I call follow the bureaucracy propaganda, dictated how we were to live our lives. Look, the CDC issued, you know, the CDC loves that they're finally relevant. The CDC used to issue, you know, warnings about the flu is out of control. Wash your hands and this, and people just fucking blew it off. Now the CDC gets to issue guidelines and schools follow them. People say, oh, we're following CDC guidelines. Even places that don't have to, businesses. Well, we're following CDC guidelines, whether it's for liability reasons or whatever. Trampled civil rights starting last spring, all in the name of health. Then that's just on the control side. And then they whipped open the central bank. They whipped out the government credit card, fired up the printing presses, and then, you know, trillions and trillions. What are we, $6 trillion in spending? I mean, there's some now just proposed. $6 trillion in spending with more proposed. Even most Republicans jumped in to support this massive spending. Trump brought us the greatest economy in the history of our country, and it didn't take stimulus, didn't take new government programs, didn't take new entitlements, didn't take any of that stuff. Just removing regulations and boom, we got the greatest economy we've ever seen in the history of our country. Man, we were rolling. Think of that. A year and 4 months ago, we were rolling. Freedom was rolling. The economy, I mean, every full employment. We didn't have to blast open more government debt. We were still accruing debt. But the tax collections on all this economic activity, I mean, we would have, because we're not going to be able to spend down the deficit. What we're going to have to do is have the private sector grow faster than the deficit if we want to ever get out of this debt crisis that the country's in. And we were doing it last year. You know, last February, last January, man, we were rolling. The stock market was rolling. The economy was rolling. Corporate income was greater than it had ever been. We were growing the private sector so fast it was beginning to many times the government grows faster than the private sector. What we saw during the last 2 years of Trump's presidency, the private sector was growing way faster than government, and that was a good thing. But the list goes on. Now we've got vaccine passports, invasion of medical privacy, mega new databases created, all in the name of the coronavirus. Given all the control that a pandemic gives government, they don't want to live and learn from that. They don't want to, quote, never let this happen again. They want to codify this. They want to make it standard protocol. When the next scandemic comes down the line, the vaccine becomes the government's control gate. Who gets the vaccine? Who doesn't get the vaccine? Who can open? Who can't? All the things from COVID that they love, the control that that gave government that they love, the vaccine's the tool for the future. And so that's the reason why Democrats are pushing the vaccine so hard. Because if we achieve, if coronavirus goes away without the majority of people getting the vaccine, that says we got through it without government. We got through it without, you know, we were able to weather the storm as a society without government. Now they'll still spin it and say, "Oh, if it wasn't for the vaccine, we wouldn't," you know. But look, even what did it say that I think I read somewhere that only 65% of healthcare workers were getting the vaccine. There's a lot of, and then, you know, this vaccine hesitancy. The thing that government hates about that is because they hate that people aren't following the government dictate. Joe Biden, all these other, you know, well, he's doesn't even know what's going on. Kamala Harris, Barack Obama, who's the one calling all the shots here, because this, let's face it, this is really the Obama-Harris administration. They hate it that people aren't doing what the government tells them to do. They hate it that the government is saying get a vaccine and people aren't doing it. They don't want us to get herd immunity without the vaccine because that weakens their psychological control the next time a virus comes down the pipe. Because they're going to need people to believe in the future that the only way to survive future pandemics is the vaccine, which the governments are going to be the ones to, through the FDA, have all the control over. That's what they don't want. And that was my, again, initially I thought, yeah, they're just trying to push everybody to the vaccine because Pfizer and Moderna are going to profit to the billions of dollars. No, it's more than that. It's, they don't want, if we get herd immunity without everybody, and that's why they want people who've already gotten the virus to get vaccinated. Because then those people will think that the vaccine gave them protection, not that they're having had the virus is what gave them protection. So that's the big play here. That's the reason that Democrats push this vaccine so hard, is because if people believe that the vaccine is what saved us, then that does tremendous things for the government's power in the future, and that's what they really don't like. Next thing I was going to talk about here tonight is a new strategy for Wisconsin Carry. Email. When Wisconsin Carry first started, we used email as our biggest communication tool with our membership. To give you a little insight how Wisconsin Carry was formed, there was a group website, opencarry.org. This was pre-Act 35. Opencarry.org was a website run by Mike Stolenwerk and John Pierce. They were out of the D.C. area. Mike Stolenwerk was retired. I think he was a retired major from the Army. I think in the Army you can retire after 20 years and then you get your pension. He decided to go to law school. I think he was going to Georgetown Law. John Pierce, another attorney, they owned opencarry.org, which promoted open carry. I was the participant on that group, on that website, opencarry.org. I'll shorten this story because I could probably do a whole show on how we formed Wisconsin Carry. There was a group of people that kind of were active participants in that opencarry.org website. The guys that owned opencarry.org, Mike Stolenwerk and John Pierce, they really started encouraging people in all the states because each state had their own section of their own, I wouldn't call it a chapter, but had their own forum on opencarry.org. There was the Wisconsin forum, the Illinois forum. So all these states, because open carry was one of the only legal ways to carry in some places that didn't have concealed carry laws. And even places that did have concealed carry laws, open carry was actually, I think it was Virginia where they started, you couldn't conceal carry into a bar, but you could open carry into a bar. So when people started going to bars, they open carried instead of concealed carried because that was legal. Again, even states that had concealed carry laws, they still pushed open carry for some of those reasons. Here in Wisconsin, open carry was the only way we could carry at all, so we were kind of pushing it for, advocating it for different reasons here in Wisconsin. But again, the great thing was that we had thousands of people that participated in that opencarry.org website, thousands of people that were carrying before Act 35. The real push to start Wisconsin Carry started when we filed a lawsuit to challenge Wisconsin's gun-free school zones, because when you were open carrying those gun-free school zones, you couldn't go into armed. And if you know anything about gun-free school zones, they're like everywhere. So what we ended up doing was filing a lawsuit to challenge that, because if we got the gun-free school zones to go away, then open carry would be more practicable, more practical to do. Because as it was then, when you got in your car to drive across town, you had to unload and encase your gun because you were probably going to drive through school zones. Back during the open carry only days, any place we went, any place we had an event, any place we always had to say, is it within a school zone? Is it within a school zone? Is it within a school zone? And obviously, private property was exempt from school zones, but if we're going to go do an open carry walk or an open carry whatever, if we're going to go do an open carry picnic, and to make sure it wasn't in a school zone. We filed that lawsuit. We started with a petition to repeal Wisconsin's gun-free school zone and circulated that. Through the circulation of the petition, everybody that signed put their email. Then we had a list of people that support this issue, and we had their emails. So then we used those email lists to start our communication to people. When we started Wisconsin Carry, we used the email list that we built from the petition to start our member database, but our mailing database. It was email. So then for the first few years, we relied heavily on email. When something happened, I sent an email out, a mass email to all Wisconsin Carry's members. And that really helped us to grow. After a while, Facebook got so easy to use that we got away from putting updates as much through email, because I could do two or three updates a day on Fascist Book. I'll still call it Facebook because this was still like in the Facebook days. Now it's Fascist Book. But this is 2009, 2010, 2011, 2012. So we started getting away. It was so much easier for me. Look, if I wanted to put a link and share something, I could just, and sometimes I didn't want to send an email for something simple like a link to a news article. But I thought our membership might be interested, but it's just, I don't want to, I've always thought less is more with emails. When I get emails from some of these places that are like two emails a week, three emails a week, sometimes tell some of these places email twice a day. What did I sign up for? Lou Malnati's Pizza. We got a Lou Malnati's Pizza and they got my email from, I think we ordered it online, and I get Lou Malnati's emails like at least once a week. Maybe it's more. Legacy Box. I just signed up for Legacy Box to get a box to send some stuff in, to get some VHS tapes, home movies digitized. And now I get like three emails from Legacy Box a day. I mean, it's just overkill. So with Wisconsin Carry, I never wanted to email too much because I didn't want to desensitize people to getting emails from Wisconsin Carry. So, but then it got so easy to use Facebook. I could just go on Facebook, post a link to a news story. Again, if it was something that wasn't even important enough to send around to everybody by an email, by a mass email, because a mass email, I had to write the email. Then I had to send it to ListBox, and then I had to go into ListBox and then send it out. It was just a multi-step process to get that email sent out to all of our membership. Whereas Facebook, I could grab a link, jump onto Facebook, make a post, cut and paste, boom. And all of our Facebook members knew. Now, one of the things I've learned, first off, Fascist Book lost its value for conservatives, for conservative activists, for networking. And the values wasn't as strong for conservatives anyway. We know recently Facebook, since Donald Trump was elected, have went full commie between their fact checkers, their content, the algorithm manipulation, all that stuff. I mean, Facebook really lost its value for conservative action, for conservative networking. But even before that, I think the value of Facebook wasn't as strong for conservatives, wasn't as strong as we thought it was. Look, liberals aren't shy. You know, liberals are loud and proud. Think about Facebook as a tool for conservative activism. Liberals, again, they're not shy. They're loud and proud. The media and entertainment establishment backs them up. The news backs them up. Celebrities back them up and really embraces them. Conservatives tend to be private. They tend to be self-conscious about sharing their beliefs. Look at the Trump polls. This is why Trump polled so low, because when people call, first off, Trump supporters tend to be the kinds that don't answer their phone for numbers they don't know. But if they do, if a pollster does get through, people aren't going to want to say, yeah, I support Trump. They don't want to get canceled. They don't trust the people who might be calling. It's just conservatives tend to have a different mindset. And it's for that different mindset that social media doesn't work as well for conservatives. Again, it's just it's an overall privacy thing for conservatives. So Facebook didn't give full exposure even before all the content manipulation started. Many conservative, first off, some people don't even check it very often. Something that was, you know, Wisconsin Carry had 12,500 members when I was banned from Fascist Book. But if I was to post something really, really popular, like let's say a victory in a lawsuit that everybody supported, that might get like 700, 800 likes. And that was a lot, but I mean, look, we had 12,500 members. Of those 12,500 members, how many people saw everything posted on the Wisconsin Carry Facebook group? Almost none of them. I don't even know what percentage saw most of the stuff. Facebook doesn't show views. And everybody's Facebook feed was different based upon either if they just let the algorithm do it or based upon their feed preferences that you could, you know, you could put like at one point, remember if you could say if you wanted to see more of something, if you want to see less of something else. So those 12,500 members, who knows, it might have only been 2,500 of them that would see a post or two from the Wisconsin Carry group every week. So the group had a lot of content. Some people would go to the group and browse the group, but other people, if they never went to the group, they just saw something that popped up in their news feed. That left, oh, sorry, I got a dry throat here today, so I keep chugging on water. That left just a big void between the potential, the number of members, and the number of actual views for something. I remember I would post something and it would sit up for, you know, a few days, and then a week later someone else would post it, and a bunch of people said, oh, I've never seen this before. And it was like, well, no, it's posted last week. Again, that's how Facebook doesn't have the exposure that you thought that it did necessarily, especially with like the Wisconsin Carry group. But again, conservatives, they tend to be private. They tend to be self-conscious about sharing their beliefs. They don't want to get canceled. This is the reason why Trump polled so low and then did so well at elections, because elections are still secret ballot. So we didn't even have full exposure before Facebook started with their algorithm manipulation and shadow banning by, you know, after Facebook could make it so that things posted in the group wouldn't show up in people's feed because they didn't want to promote the group. But so again, 12,500 members, I post a story that was like super, everybody should be, oh yeah, that's great. Maybe it got 700 likes, maybe 800. And that's for a really popular post. But some people don't even click like. So maybe double that. Maybe 1,400 people might have seen a post, because some people just don't tend to click like. They don't, you know, because you can get in trouble for liking something on Facebook. You know, you've seen people that got canceled because, oh, they liked this post on. That's been held against people. So some people don't even expose themselves. They're called lurkers. They literally just lurk. They read comments, they don't post comments, and they don't click like, because that makes them very anonymous. They're there, but you don't know they're there because they don't like anything and they don't comment on anything. So 12,500 members of Facebook, I post something really popular. It might get 700 likes. Add in the people who maybe saw it but just didn't click like and didn't comment. Let's double it. So let's say 1,400. Hell, round it up to 2,000. 2,000 people seeing a post, an important post on Facebook, that's still less than 10% of the group actually saw the posts. But now, add in content manipulation through algorithm, how Facebook manipulates content, Facebook is virtually useless for freedom. Dan O'Donnell from WISN Radio, he would talk about how in the past he'd put something up and he'd get 500 shares, which again, even if that was good, if Dan O'Donnell has 30,000 followers, 500 shares out of 30,000 followers isn't that great. Maybe if he has 30,000 followers, he'd have like, let's say 2,000 likes and 500 shares. 2,000 likes of 30,000 followers. Now, again, maybe everybody doesn't click like, so double it. 4,000 people seeing something that he posted out of his 30,000 followers, that's still a small percentage of that 30,000 people that actually saw what he posted. So again, I'm leading up to Wisconsin Carry's new strategy and how we started by using email and then we got away from it. And eventually ListBox went out of business. So I still have the database of our members, but we stopped email and we stopped using email as a communication tool. Back to Facebook, back to fascist book, the conditioning aspect of fascist book jail, even people who are outspoken conservatives, they'll avoid topics that get them a 10-day or a 30-day ban in Facebook or 30-day sentence in Facebook jail. You know, you can't post for 30 days on Facebook. Facebook, I think, learned to be careful with the ban hammer. You know, they push too hard, they push too many away, and they would enable a competitor like MeWe. But just instead of, I think they really just pushed the hardcore influencers off of Facebook. But they now I think the strategy is to leave everybody else on Facebook so Facebook remains far and away the place to be and just manipulate content because people don't respond so negatively. If people got, well, of course, if Facebook banned 30% of their users, those people are all going to go somewhere. Then you've got tens of millions of people going to MeWe. And then MeWe might get that critical mass that it would take to really make MeWe explode. So I think Facebook learned and they're not doing the ban hammer as much because they keep people on the platform. People don't know what they don't know. They don't know when their news feed is getting massively manipulated by Facebook to not show them conservative stories, stories that challenge the mainstream narrative. So when people don't know that they're being manipulated, they're less inclined to look for an alternative source. I think because right after the election, you know, there was one point where MeWe was just exploding. It was right after the election, right after Trump got banned as well. When Trump got banned from fascist book and Twitter, that's when MeWe took a big, big pop. And I remember there was news stories how MeWe's, you know, millions of downloads every day from MeWe. MeWe's the fastest growing social media platform. And then it just plateaued. And I think because Facebook pulled back on the ban lever, pulled back on the throttles a little bit and the afterburners and said, hey, instead of ruffling all the feathers and scaring people off, let's just chill and subtly, I think they call it the frog treatment, where you just slowly turn up the heat on people. They never realize that the heat's getting turned up on them. But Wisconsin Carry got away from email because Facebook was just so much easier. It was user-friendly. You could put pictures and links. It was free. But people have not abandoned their email. People still need their, you know, you still need your email to verify your social media accounts. What, you know, forget my password. That all goes back to your email. So email still works. And I would argue that I think email is probably a better platform for conservatives than any other social media in terms of communicating, because I can't tell you how many times I posted things 2, 3, 5 times on fascist book and people would say, oh, I never saw that. And that's why I'd approve stuff that had been posted a week earlier, because I knew with another round of it being posted, new eyes would see it a week later. They didn't see it the time it was posted a week before. But also people will engage with email. With email, people can give you private feedback. And also email, it goes to the open rate for Wisconsin Carry's. People haven't abandoned email. So I think email gets a wider reach. Back from ListBox, when Wisconsin Carry used ListBox for our email, it would show like 75% open rate. 75% of people would open the emails they got from Wisconsin Carry. I guarantee fascist book never, never got a 75% read rate on posts. 12,500 members on Fascist Book. 12,500. Oops, can't do 12,500 times 0.75. That would be 9,375 people reading a particular post on the Wisconsin Carry Fascist Book Group. I guarantee that never happened. I would bet a body part that 9,375 people never all saw a single post on Fascist Book in the Wisconsin Carry group. Those 12,500 members of Wisconsin Carry's Facebook group, Fascist Book group, I'd be willing to bet a body part. Won't tell you which one, but I'd be willing to bet a body part that 9,375 people never saw that a post never got 9,375 views. People actually saw it. But with email, if I was to send an email out to 12,500 Wisconsin Carry members, that's what we would get for an open rate. 75% of the people would open it. So I think it was a mistake for Wisconsin Carry, and I'll take blame for it. It was my fault because Fascist Book was just so goddamn convenient. But I think email has a wider reach. I think people will engage with email because it's private. They can give private feedback. People who wouldn't even click like on social media, lurkers who wouldn't comment, they're more likely to respond to an email one-on-one. And they'll even say stuff like, you know, please keep my name confidential, but tips, ideas, inside information. I used to hear from people all the time. People would read something I would post. This happened on Facebook so often. In addition to the Wisconsin Carry Facebook group, I admin and I'm the founder of the New Berlin Taxpayers Alliance as well. I'd post something, and I use that because it's a local. I'd post something in the New Berlin Taxpayers Alliance Facebook group, and I'd maybe get 10 likes. But I'd have like three people private message me, and they'd say something like, oh, I'm all in favor of what you posted on the New Berlin Taxpayers Alliance page, but I didn't want to say so publicly. So I don't click like, and I don't, you know, because I don't want other parents, you know, my kids' friends' parents seeing what I liked on social media or seeing a comment from me. So they would respond privately in private message on Facebook. And that was all even before cancel culture set in. So even now after cancel culture, you know, most people, again, I recognize and I gave up my anonymity years ago. When I decided to be I accepted the role as president of Wisconsin Carry, my anonymity went out the door and I knew it. I became a public figure. I knew my future business endeavors would be affected by it. And they are. I've been at trade shows with my company and people said, oh, you know, you're that gun guy, you know. When you came to our board meeting, you weren't carrying a gun, were you? I mean, I've had people say that to me. So fortunately, my business has done well enough in spite of that. I mean, I'm not a big enough celebrity to where I have a household name in Wisconsin. So, but I have had people recognize me. Well, I mean, that happens all the time. I have people recognize me. But again, my point being that I think email lost its, and I'll take the blame for it, we stopped using email. I think that was a mistake. So we're going to go back to it. We're going to go back to email. I'm going to. I haven't decided if it's going to be MailChimp or Constant Contact, but I'm going to put Wisconsin Carry's database back in, and we're going to start emailing more frequently to reach our membership. And the ironic part is, I believe that we'll end up reaching more people by going back to email instead of relying on Facebook. And I'd even put it on our social media. I said, you know, the best way to keep in touch with Wisconsin Carry is to join our Facebook page because we no longer send emails. You know, it was a mistake. And I'll take the blame for it, but it was a mistake. So, all right. Last topic today is a story from Journal Sentinel Online that was about a court case in Wisconsin. So I want to read something about this real quick. Oh, and how do I do this? I got to open this in an incognito window. So hang on. Sorry about this. With Journal Sentinel Online, you can no longer, if you read, and I refuse to pay for a subscription to that liberal rag. So I need to cut and paste the link. Because they use cookies, if you paste a link into what they call a private window on Brave, I use Brave browser for most of my stuff now. They call it an incognito window on Chrome. But, okay, so I've got a link open now. Even in your own home, you can't carry a gun while drunk unless acting in self-defense. Bruce Vilmetti from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I work with Bruce, or I talk to Bruce a lot. He emailed me this past week about the case that Wisconsin Carry funded that lost in Green Bay federal court. I'll talk about that right here at the end of the show. Michael Christen admitted he drank 4 beers and a shot before walking around his Madison apartment with a gun in his waistband one night back in 2018. That made his roommates and visitors nervous, and someone punched Christen in the chest and took away the gun. So he retreated to his room, cocked his other gun, a shotgun, and called 911. So Christen called 911, this guy, Mitchell Christen. He's the one that called 911. But when the cops showed up, they charged Christen with going armed while intoxicated, a misdemeanor. A judge later convicted him, and a judge sentenced him to 4 months in jail, but that sentence has been on hold while Christen appealed. He lost at the Court of Appeals, but the Wisconsin Supreme Court agreed to take his case and address this question. Does the consumption of a legal intoxicant void the Second Amendment's guarantee of the right to carry a firearm for the purpose of self-defense? On Tuesday, that was this past Tuesday, the High Court in Wisconsin ruled 6-1 that the law against carrying a gun while drunk was not unconstitutional as applied to Christen because the jury at his trial found he wasn't acting in self-defense at the time. In a 21-page dissent, Justice Rebecca Bradley, she's awesome, said the law violated Christen's right to carry a gun in his own home in case of confrontation, even if he was drunk. In this decision, the majority overrides the will of the people by circumscribing the fundamental constitutional right to bear arms in case of confrontation in the home, she wrote. Christen thought a famous 2008 Supreme Court case about gun rights was squarely in his favor. In that case, District of Columbia v. Heller, the court said the Second Amendment protected an individual's right to keep and bear arms apart from any militia and rejected the city's outright ban, District of Columbia's outright ban, and restrictions on how long guns must be stored in homes. But the trial judge in Court of Appeals pointed out that the Heller case assured that right for law-abiding responsible, that's the quotation. The Court of Appeals found that the Heller case assured that right for law-abiding responsible citizens. Writing for the majority, Chief Justice Annette Ziegler observed that laws against intoxicated use of weapons were in place around the time of the nation's founding in the 18th century. Wisconsin's law doesn't ban ownership of a gun, the court notes, just carrying it while intoxicated. So Christen's core Second Amendment rights weren't at risk. That means the law need only be substantially related to a legitimate government purpose. That the majority found was to advance public safety and protect people from the often volatile, sometimes deadly combination of guns and alcohol. Justice Brian Hagedorn agreed with the majority's conclusion, but wrote a separate opinion because in his view, this is, I've heard how Hagedorn does things. Judge Brian Hagedorn apparently thinks he's the smartest guy in the room in any room he's ever in. I think I'm the smartest guy in the room, but only in the room that I'm only in. Like I've said that about the show, I'm the smartest guy in the room. That's because I'm the only guy in the room. It's a joke. But Hagedorn, in his view, the majority's analysis is insufficiently rooted in the original public meaning of the Second Amendment. Hagedorn cited many historical examples of government criminalizing armed intoxication as ways to curtail reckless gun use that didn't violate the Second Amendment. He said it was unnecessary to engage in the more intricate legal approach taken by the majority to uphold Wisconsin's law against going armed while intoxicated. So, I posted this to the Wisconsin Carry MeWe page. I mean, I agree with Rebecca Bradley's dissent on this one. I think we're setting a terrible precedent here that if you're intoxicated, you don't have the right to carry. You still have the right to self-defense, but in other words, if you're not actively involved in self-defense, because if he would have been actively defending himself, using his gun to defend himself, well, that's legal, even if you're intoxicated. But okay, let's look at it this way. It's legal to drink and drive. It's legal to be drunk at home. And I don't play into this whole FOIC, firearm owner's inferiority complex, that carrying a gun is the equivalent to driving a car. I've always said a gun in the holster is the equivalent of your car parked in the garage. Should someone get charged for drunk driving for having a car parked in the garage while they're drunk? Now, look, if this guy had shot his gun, discharged his gun while he was drunk, fuck it. Charge him with a crime. But I would argue that having a gun in a holster, or just having a gun in your possession, not pointing it at someone, not threatening someone, just having a gun in your possession, that's more the equivalent of having a car parked in your garage than it is driving your car. Firing your gun, pointing it at somebody, you know, twirling it on your finger, okay, those things are more akin to driving your car. But having a gun in a holster or having a gun in your possession but not pointing it at someone, I would equate that to more like having a car parked in your garage. And you don't get charged with drunk driving for having a car parked in your garage. You don't even get charged with drunk driving if you have your keys in your pocket and you go out to your garage and you sit next to your car. You don't get charged with drunk driving. But you get charged with intoxicated possession of a firearm for having a firearm in a holster. I don't agree with it. So again, pulling the gun out and doing something harmful with it, sure. I mean, that's a crime. But that didn't happen in this case. This guy didn't harm anybody. He didn't threaten anyone. If he had, I mean, sure, book him, Dano. But if all he did was arm himself at home, sorry, I think it's really, really, really bad precedent to set for the entire state, because that's what the Wisconsin Supreme Court precedent means, for the entire state of Wisconsin, that being armed, intoxicated, for whatever that means, because for driving, intoxicated is 0.08 or above, or you fail stupid human tricks. For drunk, for drinking, there is no legal standard for intoxication. It's not written into the statute. We assume that they're probably going to use the same statute or same standards that they use for drunk driving, 0.08, but that's just an assumption. That's not codified. There's no case law. There's no statutes to define it. But again, really, really bad precedent to set for the entire state that being armed, intoxicated at home is a crime in and of itself. And this is where I'm back to my coined phrase of FOIC, firearm owner's inferiority complex. Look, everybody's entitled to their opinion, and I'm not trying to change everybody's mind. But I love gun debates like this. Part of what I miss from being banned from Fascist Book and the Wisconsin Curry Group there, which I grew to the size that it was, is, you know, first I learned that if you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. If you do read the newspaper, you're misinformed. So I don't believe much of what I read in the paper. So as far as this case, how the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel describes these circumstances, look, I think someone hit him in the chest, this Christian guy, and he called the police. I mean, if that doesn't tell you that he feared for his safety, what does? He didn't fear for his safety enough to use his gun, so grave danger, great bodily harm wasn't imminent. He remembered the four conditions to justify use of deadly force. But he obviously felt like he was in danger because he called the police. And they came. And then they cite him instead of the person who assaulted him. So again, I don't necessarily believe what I read in the paper here that was accurately reported on, but what happened in this case is so much bigger than this guy. And that's really my point here. Precedent set at the Wisconsin Supreme Court doesn't apply to just this guy in just his specific case. Like, okay, yeah, great, he's guilty, he should be guilty. This precedent now applies to everybody in the state of Wisconsin. Everybody in the state of Wisconsin is now, for anybody in the state of Wisconsin, if you get drunk at home and you're possessing a gun, that means within reach, you're committing a crime. even if you don't do anything bad. Look, maybe this guy was a dweeb, this guy from Madison who took this case to the Supreme Court. Maybe he's not. Maybe his friend should have been the one charged with assault. The guy with the gun harmed no one, but it sounds like he was assaulted by his roommates or someone that was there, someone that was in the house. But I give the benefit of the doubt to the citizens, to the Constitution. I err on the side of freedom. So in this case, even if there's any doubt, I would err, when I read these stories, I err on the side of freedom. And I would have found this guy, I would have overturned his conviction. But even so, Supreme Court precedent doesn't care. Supreme Court precedent that applies in this case, that's going to apply to every future case. If you are intoxicated at home, and I say you, I mean you listening to this podcast in Wisconsin, if you are intoxicated at home and you're sitting watching the Packer game on your patio with your gun and a holster on your hip or maybe on the table next to you in your own backyard under your umbrella with your little outdoor TV and you got your feet in the air and you're drinking a couple beers and then your wife brings another beer and it's a good game and you have a couple more beers, you indulge a little bit too much. And your fucking lib fuck neighbor that hates that you have a Trump flag on your house, she sees you out in your backyard drinking beers, watching the Packer game with your gun sitting on the table or sitting on your or in the holster on your hip. She calls the police on you. Oh my God, my neighbor has a gun and he's drinking. You're intoxicated. You're at home. You're in possession of a gun. You are not engaged in self-defense at that moment. The Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision in this case has declared that that's a crime for everyone. So whatever people's feelings are specifically about this case, someone on the Wisconsin Media Group said, guns and alcohol don't mix. Well, that's bullshit because do cars and alcohol mix? Because it's legal to drink and drive. If guns and alcohol don't mix, then surely cars and alcohol shouldn't mix. And look at how big the parking lots are at bars. Look at how many people are drinking at Brewer games. I mean, if guns and alcohol don't mix, then certainly alcohol and cars don't mix. You shouldn't be serving beer at Brewer games because everybody drove there. And they're not all the designated driver. Give me a break. Self-defense doesn't and shouldn't just be the case when you're actively facing an imminent danger or a threat. Because that may be too late. But the precedent that was set in this case means, again, if you're intoxicated and you're not actively engaged in self-defense by using your firearm, shooting someone, self-defense doesn't, I'm going to say this again, self-defense doesn't and shouldn't be the case just when you're actively facing an imminent danger or threat because then it may be too late. If you can't be in possession of a gun until you face a deadly threat that justifies the use of deadly force, well, then what? Okay, back to the scenario. You're on your front porch drinking beers. Your Trump flag's waving in the breeze in front of your house. A Black Lives Matter fucknut goes walking by, walks onto your property to tear your flag down. Well, you're not going to let someone interfere with your property, and you have a legal right to use non-deadly force to protect your property. You can't use deadly force to protect property. You can only use deadly force to protect your life, but you can use non-deadly force. So you're on your porch. You're drinking a couple beers. A BLM thug goes walking by, walks onto your property to tear down your Trump flag. You get up to use non-deadly force to protect your property. Black Lives Matter thug pulls a gun on you, which is a deadly threat. What do you say? Oh, hang on a second, good sir. Please allow me a moment to go fetch my gun from the safe upstairs as I couldn't possess it for self-defense on my porch because I was drinking, according to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. But now that you have presented a deadly threat, I may, according to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, use a gun in self-defense even if I'm intoxicated. This ruling sucks ass. And I guarantee this ruling from the Wisconsin Supreme Court is going to ensnare law-abiding citizens who did nothing wrong, threatened no one, and they were merely possessing a gun for personal safety on their own property, in their own home, and they happened to be intoxicated. And here's the problem. Too many people want to judge a situation on the feelings about a specific person, but the law shouldn't do that. And was this guy a douche from Madison? I don't know. I don't trust the news reporting. You shouldn't either. But this is a bigger picture issue than this guy, and principles come first. So the notion that the court said that you can be intoxicated and use deadly force to protect yourself. You don't lose the right to self-defense just because you're intoxicated, but you lose the right to carry when you're intoxicated. The nature of threats to your life come about so quickly that by prohibiting one, you're incapacitating the other. If you can't carry while you're intoxicated, you wouldn't be able to defend yourself. Again, other than the situation I said is in a true, like, if you're in your house and someone comes breaking in and they break in and chase you upstairs and they've got a gun, they say they're going to kill you, and you get to your bedroom where your gun is stored safely away because you were intoxicated or you were drinking and you were drunk at home, and you turn around, you shot the intruder, then it was okay to be intoxicated in possession of a gun because you were using it for self-defense. But if you'd had it in your possession for safety before someone broke in, that's illegal. Again, this ruling just, it doesn't make any sense. And it's impractical from the standpoint of a legitimate ability to defend yourself. So, yeah. So that's another shitty decision that came out of the Wisconsin Supreme Court this week. And it was 6-1. That's, you know, we don't have a bunch of people up there, and even in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, save for Justice Rebecca Bradley. She's awesome. I mean, I don't know if I've ever seen her on the side of a case that I thought was wrong. I don't know. She just always seems to be on the money with these cases. The other ones, you know, who's our other conservative justice? Well, Hagedorn's really not that conservative. Ziegler's supposedly a conservative. There's Rebecca Bradley. Annette Ziegler, Hagedorn. Well, what's the guy? Gableman? Gableman's supposedly a conservative. That's four. Rebecca Dallet is the liberal. Who's the other? Ann Walsh Bradley, I think she's the liberal. And then I think the old lady, the old hag, I think she retired, if I remember correctly, or didn't run for re-election or something. Anyway, I'm just trying to think of the justices on the Wisconsin Supreme Court here up the top of my head. But 6-1, only one of them is hardcore pro-gun. Hardcore understands the Second Amendment. That's Rebecca Bradley. So that's not the most comforting of realizations that in Madison we don't have a lot of tepid support for right to carry. But this one, I don't even think this one should have been close. I think these justices, because this case in particular, the guy seemed like someone they didn't want to overturn his conviction. I think they set really bad precedent instead. And look, the law says, I mean, it's better for an innocent person or guilty person to go free than an innocent person to be convicted. I think it's better for a guilty person to go free than innocent people to have their rights infringed. And that's the reason I think this is a bad ruling. So, all right, you guys, that's the show. Hope you had a great week. Hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, let me know. Shoot me an email, nick@wisconsincarry.org or wisconsincarry@gmail.com. Love to hear from you. You guys have a great week. Carry on. Be well armed.
This is Sniper Chick Julie. You've been listening to Well Armed Radio, and I have to know, is that a gun in your pants, or did you just really enjoy the show?
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.